is Ruffin versus City of Seattle.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jack Sheridan. I represent Becky Ruffin, and we'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttals.
All right, you may proceed.
Thanks. The trial court abused its discretion in that it used the wrong legal standard in evaluating sanctions under Faisons and Magana. The court found that the city did not willfully or deliberately violate the discovery rules or the court's discovery order in the case. Faisons tells us that intent need not be shown before sanctions are mandated. The conduct is to be measured against the spirit and purpose of the rules. And both Faisons and Magana say, don't blame the victim, which happened in this case. CR 26G was violated, as was CR 37. And in determining whether an attorney has complied with the rule, CR 26G, the court should consider all of the surrounding circumstances, the importance of the evidence to its proponents, and the ability of the opposing party to formulate a response or to comply with the request. The responses have to be consistent with the letter, spirit, and purpose of the rules. In Faisons, it was the misleading nature of the company's responses that the court held was contrary to the purpose of discovery, and which is most damaging to the fairness of the litigation process. Here, the defendants misled the plaintiff by not identifying Mr. Mahara as a direct report to Carrasco in interrogatory 13. Defendant did not even respond to RFP 6 and 7, which would have produced what we've identified as the smoking gun. They did not seek a protective order, which was their duty to do under Faisons. And then when we moved to compel, Ms. Johnson, Devonna Johnson, submitted a declaration in response to the motion saying that we had all the documents.
Would you focus on Miyahara for a moment?
Sure.
As I recall, the trial court said it was reasonable not to have searched his email. So would you explain his role and his function and why they should have reasonably anticipated that?
Yes. So, as I said, interrogatory 13 asks for direct reports. The testimony in the record is he was a direct report to Carrasco. He wore several hats. He was an HR manager. He was also involved in the process of acquisition, meaning the process of hiring. So everything about him fixed in time was made, showed that he was important, and also he was
when was that officer. When was that first apparent to you?
It was apparent to us in the PRA litigation that followed. We never
not
knew.
Not in the earlier litigation?
Not at all. The last thing that happened that the Judge Andrus said we should have sort of gleaned that he might be important was right at the close of discovery, we deposed an individual, Ms. Hartley, who then said that she wrote a letter telling Ms. Ruffin that she was not going to be considered for a job and that it was Mr. Mahara that was his boss. He was sort of the force behind it, but that was right at the end of discovery. The thing to keep in mind here, and I don't want to jump around too much, but that after the order was issued, we still didn't get an updated version of interrogatory 13 asking for who were the direct reports telling us about Mahara. We still didn't get the smoking gun documents in response to...
But as I recall, the trial court's order when it was contested about the breadth of discovery was a reasonable search and specifically the four people that were being argued about. And theirs was searched, and you've got the other issue there. But when the trial court comes back and says, no, it was reasonable not to go there, isn't that a factual determination that we don't revisit?
Well, I think here you have to revisit because there's a mountain of evidence that shows that he really was a core figure in the case. And it's an abuse of discretion to find otherwise because they had superior knowledge. That's the thing that, Faisons tells us, is that when we ask a question, we ask a question without knowing what the answer is. The defendant had the answer. They knew that Mahara was an important character in this. Mahara, one of the things I love to look at is he was getting copied on every piece of litigation during the during the underlying discrimination litigation. CP 117 is him getting receiving copies of the CP 260 is him receiving copies of the motion to compel. So the idea that nobody knows his importance doesn't make any sense. And when you look at the smoking gun and you look at what did Haynes do, Haynes basically, after giving Ms. Rufin very high marks, something happens, and he then has a third interview, an unusual third interview with his boss, where suddenly he doesn't hire her, and when the guy who does get offered the job doesn't take it, he doesn't hire her as the runner-up.
Yeah, but point in time issues. He's getting copies of the litigation. That's
yes.
That's going on before the Records Act complaint. It's
correct.
Not the application process.
No, that's after she sues. But there's only a couple months that pass. This is all happening.
So during the litigation, did you know he was getting copies of the litigation file?
No, not until the PRA litigation.
Okay.
All of that came out in the PRA litigation. And when you look at the importance of this smoking gun email to us, we couldn't connect the dots. In closing, the defense said, you know, they don't have a shred of evidence.
Well,
but look who Haynes writes to when he needs advice about what to do.
Right.
He just writes to Mahara and Johnson.
So there's one email.
Yes.
Okay. If his role were vital in reviewing the litigation and in being a participant in this decision, wouldn't you have expected email responding to that email or other email? I mean, isn't it fair for the trial court in making a factual determination of the reasonableness to say this is the only email, it doesn't evidence participation?
Not in this case, because they destroy all their emails after 45 days. So we didn't have the treasure trove you do in other cases.
Well, apparently,
destroy them.
Apparently he didn't, because...
Right. That's right. He
so
did not.
Are you asking us to assume that he selected this one for archiving, but...
He's the only attorney.
Dismiss the other one?
Yes, I think that's right. He's the only attorney. We don't know if he had a legal hold on him, but that's right. Thanks.
We'll have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Bruce for Seattle City Light and for Jorge Carrasco. I will get into Mr. Mahara about a minute and a half into this, unless you'd like me to jump on him right now.
Well, the tone of my questioning might have heartened you a little bit, but how the hell can we expect that it's not reasonable to look at his emails when doing a record search, when he's monitoring litigation, when he's getting informed of the application process, and he supervises records officers?
So,
I mean, how can the judge make a factual determination that's reasonable? There's nothing that supports that logical inference. So get into it when you want.
I think I should address it now. So, a couple of things. First, the record is actually not entirely clear as to exactly what Mr. Mahara's role was at various points in time. I know the courts reviewed the record in some detail. He did wear different hats. The record actually is that for most of the time, and most of the organization charts you'll see in the record show him reporting to Ms. Johnson. So there's some evidence to the contrary, but it's
so then he'd be downstream of her stream of things.
That's right.
More
and making him actually less no, actually making him less important. Two things I do want to pick up on this right away. First of all, the trial court actually did address his role in some detail at page 8 of her opinion. She does make findings of fact about this, and they are entitled to deference. Second, the burden, and it is a heavy burden, is on the plaintiff. And the plaintiff gave us no more evidence of Mr. Mahara's role than what you have in the record. If there's a failure of proof around Mr. Mahara, it is a failure of the plaintiff to make the clear and convincing showing she needs to make. Third, interestingly enough, nearly identical issues already have been thoroughly litigated and resolved by this court. As the court understands, in the retaliation lawsuit, the lawsuit that we're here on right now, there was a dispute about the scope of discovery. Judge Andrus ordered that certain people's email be searched. She did not order a search of Mahara's email. She did say look at any other places where responsive email might be found. We did that.
So Mahara was never deposed and didn't testify at any point in the trial proceeding?
Or in the later Public Records Act litigation, which actually served as a year-and-a-half process of discovery in aid of this 60B4 motion. There's simply nothing in the record, really, from Mr. Mahara himself.
But Judge Andrus here made findings that maybe he should have thought himself about this, but it wasn't. There was no sense of bad faith or unreasonableness by the city in not doing that.
I think Judge Andrus reached some inference about what happened that was fair. But it is true that there is no testimony in the record from Mr. Mahara, and that is actually, as I say, it's very clear the burden here is on the plaintiff, not on the city. What I wanted to mention, though, is in the Public Records Act case, in which this court issued an opinion just a few months ago, a very similar issue arose, because in that case, there was an agreement to search certain email records for a very similar set of requests, and this email wasn't found again. They didn't look in Mahara's email in that case until months later. Ms. Rafine asked them to specifically look at the Public Records Act email, and they found it. And they found it, and Ms. Rafine took that as an issue to Judge Bowman. She lost, and that issue, the failure to find the email there, came to this court on appeal. And what this court said in the Public Records Act, case was, quote, Mahara's account was not a place reasonably likely to find emails by or between Johnson, Kern, Carrasco, Haynes, or the law department, and, quote, Rafine failed to present any evidence that Mahara remembered or even saw the email in question. So to sort of long-windedly respond, A, the burden is on the plaintiff. B, there's no showing that he had any substantial role in any of this. And C, I would submit this court already has addressed the issue of Mahara's involvement
in
very similar
the evidence that he was being copied on the litigation and monitoring the litigation.
Yes.
Why shouldn't the public records officer have known that he was likely to be copied in on email about the litigation?
Right. So I am not entirely sure I am understanding the question. Let me try, and if I'm not, please correct me. He was copied on email by me, among other people, or my office, about the litigation, the retaliation litigation, after that litigation had commenced. He was copied in his capacity as a member of a client group. At some point in time, he had a role at City Light as a legal affairs officer or something like that. That he was copied as a client does not mean or establish that he was a precipient witness in the litigation, or excuse me, in the underlying events.
No, and you may well have reasons to block disclosure of the identified communications on the exemption log. But my point is,
yes,
why isn't it reasonable to assume anyone in the chain of command reviewing public disclosure requests, let alone reviewing the litigation file about which the requests are there, would be a source for potential copies of, if not direct, communication?
I still don't think that. If I copy general counsel on litigation. I'm representing a corporation. I copy general counsel. That doesn't mean that I ought to be or that general counsel ought to be reviewing his materials. I'm not sure I'm answering the question, though.
Certainly after this case is public, if it isn't already known that the city does not archive all emails for 2 or 3 years and that people generally have 2 or 3 years to bring a lawsuit, that I suspect that generally the argument when the city says your request is overbroad will be, no, it's not overbroad because individuals don't have to archive email, so we're entitled to look anywhere it could have been forwarded, anywhere it could have been consulted, cross-filed, or anything else. And in this case, if it's a person that supervises litigation and supervises public disclosure requests and would be in the loop on employment things, it must be reasonable to expect that person to be copied on something. So there's some chance that there would be a copy there, even if it's not in the sender's file.
Yeah, I take issue with the court, and with apologies and respect, on that last connection. That is, just because the client representative is copied on things in the litigation means that they also must have been in the loop on stuff relating
not
to the
must
underlying
have been.
Events. Or it's but reasonable
for the,
to
but
think
for the
they
public
were.
Records officer to make a reasonable search, it's got to be who could be in the loop, not
sure.
Who must have been in the loop.
Sure. And I think Judge Andrus acknowledged, in fact, in her order, that perhaps he should have thought of that. Perhaps he should have thought of it.
Well, how can she conclude,
but she,
as a matter of fact, it was a reasonable search if, in fact, he didn't search where he should have searched?
Because he was not the searcher. The searchers were the people from the Seattle City Attorney's Office, the paralegal, all of
right, I'm referring to the searcher. How can she conclude that the searcher conducted a reasonable search when he did not search where he should have known to search?
Right. Because she did not think that they should have known to search there based on what they knew at the time. They submitted declarations, and of course this is the court that was familiar with all of the underlying litigation, and there was nothing in response. There was nothing developed about Mr. Mehara in response by the plaintiff. Judge Andrus looked at all of the evidence.
You're saying that is a finding of fact as opposed to a conclusion of law?
Yeah,
supported by the record.
Absolutely. And again, I would say that it is a finding very similar to the finding that was made by Judge Bowman and that was reviewed and affirmed by this court in the Public Records Act case with respect, again, to not finding the same email that ultimately showed up in Mr. Mehara's account. So, in my remaining 40 seconds, the bar is high. Everybody agrees that Ms. Rafine has a heavy burden, and the reason for that is because Rule 60 is an extraordinary remedy, and that is because trials matter, not least because they are time-consuming and we must move forward, as the court said in Lotus. The results of trials matter, the manner in which the trial takes place, the evidence admitted, it all matters. She has a heavy burden. We must respect the finality of proceedings. She can't make her showing here. I urge you to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. You have 3 minutes.
Thanks. Well, Your Honor, just to put the fact issue to bed, at CP 620 and 621, Josh Walters is appointed by the city to be a 30B6 witness, and he says at the time of the PRA search, Mehara reported to Jorge Carrasco. So there's no doubt, as a matter of fact, that Interrogatory 13 should have produced his name, and then we would have known to ask RFP questions about him, and there's no doubt that RFP 6 and 7 should have produced that particular smoking gun document. Remember that what the defense did is similar to what the attorneys did in Magana. In Magana, they only looked in the legal department. They didn't look further. Here, it's the same thing. They artificially looked in places where the answer would not be. And remember that is exactly what happened in Faison's. In Faison's, Bogle and Gates basically, they differentiated between the product, which was somophylline oral liquid, and they didn't provide information that had to do with theophylline, which was the main ingredient. They didn't want to give up the name of their doctor, and they didn't want to give up the documents that he had. Similarly here, the city does not include him in interrogatory 13, and under RFP 6 and 7, they don't. It's not that they answer partially. They don't answer at all. They just object to 6 and 7. So we don't get the documents at the beginning because they've basically they don't seek a protective order, they just don't answer. And then after they're ordered, they don't produce them. If the court has no other questions, then that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, that concludes this calendar. The court is adjourned.